Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. As I think most everybody knows, tonight's a triple header. We've got Saturday night, Half Moon One Pra, and Ajahn Chah Memorial Day, all bound up in one evening. Special day. And I thought I'd just start the evening with a few reflections, maybe not too long, and then also, since it's the Ajahn Chah Memorial Day, I thought just to read a teaching from Ajahn Chah himself, a transcribed talk, translated, of course, into English. But to start with just a few reflections that, of course, I never met Ajahn Chah. I came on the scene too late. I started practicing more or less with this tradition the last couple of years or so that he was still alive and deteriorating, and never made it to Thailand before he passed away. So all of my experience or understanding of Ajahn Chah is from many different sources, not ever having seen him in person. And it's interesting, I think probably most everybody has their own experience of Ajahn Chah. He was a multifaceted being with a tremendous range of influence. One of his teachings was explaining how we determine our reality into existence, or Ajahn Jeff's word, suppose experience into existence in a way by the determinations or the suppositions that we make. And Ajahn Chah would explain that in terms of examples, like say this that I'm holding in my hand. At its base, it's a collection of elements, earth element, probably a few other small amounts of elements mixed in there, but primarily earth element. It has a certain shape and color and texture to it, and that's what it is. And it's only us that determines it as a clock. So based on our perceptual tendencies, our memories, our experience, the labels that we learn as we grow up, this is a clock. But from its own side, it's just what it is. It's just this collection of whatever. But it's us who makes it a clock, so we determine things. We do that with everything around us. And Ajahn Chah would point that out, that our world is a world of determinations, not the least of which is how we determine ourselves and people around us in the same way. One experience of a person can be very different from somebody else's experience of a person based on the whole perceptual patterns that we've developed in relation to seeing that particular form across the room from us. I remember a teaching Ajahn Sumedho would give on occasion, and the first time I heard it was at a retreat. This was before I was a monk, and I was co-managing this retreat at Cloud Mountain, co-managing it with Debbie, and so she was there and probably remembers the same teaching with Ajahn Sumedho sitting in the front of the room and talking about self, not self. And he would say, okay, here I am, sitting here in the front of the room, and you're creating me. Stop creating me. I'm here now, but now I'm not here. So stop creating me. I'm not here. So just pointing out very pointedly, I was very struck by that teaching, and how we determine things into existence, determine people, suppose people into existence, based on a certain set of qualities that we remember. And I've done that, of course, with Ajahn Chah. Ajahn Chah is a determined experience for me, based on many, many different things. So I think of the number of ways that I've come to form that image of him in my own mind. And of course, initially it was through hearing about him from the Western teachers that I first encountered, Ajahn Sumedho, Lumpa Pasano, Ajahn Pasano, Ajahn Amaro, others who spent various amounts of time with Lumpa Cha and would tell stories, and I would form images and ideas of who he was. And then started doing some readings and hearing different teachings that he had given and would passed on from other people, or talks that were maybe recorded and transcribed and written down. In my early days, there wasn't very much translated and available at that time, just a little bit, a few small books and pamphlets. Still Forest Pool. I remember one of the ones that made a very strong impression on me was the brief description when I first read something from Ajahn Chah. Was somebody was trying to get an idea of what his mind was like and posed that question in some way. And Ajahn Chah's description of his own mind was as if it were like a tree with many branches, and that various creatures would come and alight in the branches, stay for a period of time, and then fly on or move on. Kind of equating, I think, his mind as the central awareness, as different from the objects that would come and stay for a period of time and then move on, and in realizing the distinction between the two. And very early on, that image struck me very strongly. This is somebody I want to learn more about. I want to know more of his teachings. This makes sense in its profundity and its simplicity. One of the other teachings that I first came across of his in the early days was just the small pamphlet. Many people have seen it in that form or in some of his collected teachings, Our Real Home, which was a teaching that he gave to a woman, a lay woman who was dying. And it was, I had just been doing some starting work with hospice nursing, and of course had my own training and experience in that. And when I was reading this and the way that he was talking with her, and the directness and no mincing of words and his instructions to her. Of course, she was a disciple and knew the teaching, knew the language, but the incredible clarity and not mincing words of what was happening to her and where she needed to take her refuge was striking to me. Again, supporting that wish to get to know these teachings and Ajahn Chah's in his style more closely. So my image of him was beginning to form in my mind, who he was. He was a very profound, wise, straightforward teacher. Other images that come are from some of the video clips that are out there, some of the documentaries that have been made about Wapapong and the tradition as it comes to the West, various images, and I think I've incorporated and maybe even created some of my own images from stories that Lungpa has told and others of just his, not only his physical stature, short and squat, a little bit round, but very solid and powerful presence, and very light and light-hearted as well. You know, it wasn't from a video clip that I saw, but a story that I heard of. For some reason, it's an image that struck me very clearly, and I maintain this as a story in my mind of Ajahn Chah, of one of his visits to the West, and he was taken to the Insight Meditation Center, Insight Meditation Society, IMS, in Barre, Massachusetts, for a visit and to do some teachings. And it was a retreat of sorts, and so they were having periods of sitting and walking meditation, as usual. And as was taught there at that time, and I think still is, pretty much from the Burmese style. So the walking meditation during the walking periods outdoors would be that particular style that they taught, of the very slow walking meditation, you know, lift, push, step, very deliberate, very slow motion kind of walking meditation back and forth. And if you've ever been to IMS, you know that it's a very big mansion that's got a nice large lawn in the front of it. And I can't remember if it actually has a stone fence around or if I've supposed that into existence in my memory, but for some reason I have that as a memory. I was only there once quite a few years ago. But in some ways, it kind of fits the image of a mental hospital, an insane asylum. And you can imagine what it might look like with people out there doing their very slow walking meditation, lifting, pushing, placing, lifting, pushing, placing, on this lawn in front of this big mansion in the countryside. And how Ajahn Chah perceived that, because the story that I heard was that he was somewhat amused by that, because that's not the walking style anyway in the Thai tradition, and that his comments as he would walk by people who were doing that would be, "I hope you recover soon. May you get better. May you recover." So I don't know how much of that story is true or accurate in the words that I used, but it's an image I hold of Ajahn Chah as being not at all hesitant to poke fun and get people to look at what they're doing and to inject a little bit of lightheartedness into the serious way that we all take on this practice sometimes. Also have to say that a lot of my image of Ajahn Chah comes through Lungpa Patsano, and I can only imagine that all of the years that he spent with Ajahn Chah, learning from him, practicing his teaching, practicing his way of life at Wat Pa Pong, and the years that he spent caring for him and looking after him in his periods of illness had a huge influence on him as well. And when I, you know, the almost 20 years that I've had the privilege of spending with Lungpa here, I just sometimes see Ajahn Chah permeating through him. Of course, you know, he has his own ways of manifesting and his own ways of expressing the teachings, but I see Ajahn Chah so much in Lungpa. Just his stature, he's kind of short and broad as well. But in the style of solidity, continuity, stability, that solid as a rock kind of a feeling, and also the lightness, the humor, and the kindness, the immense commitment to practice, and the humility with which he takes that on, the relentless commitment to developing monastic community, first and foremost, holding the monastic community at the center, just as I understand Ajahn Chah did, but also being very aware that this is a community of a much broader capacity, not just the monastics, but the lay residents in the monastery, the various concentric circles of lay supporters nearby, from far away, people who come and stay for long periods of time, people who come in and out for shorter periods of time, and the commitment to training all of us. I see that same commitment that Lungpa Pasano grew up with in the Ajahn Chah communities, and picking that up and realizing the importance of that and continuing that legacy from Ajahn Chah. So when I see Lungpa, I know I'm experiencing some of Ajahn Chah as well. And then, of course, all the teachings and the way that Lungpa Cha created the community that's grown into, you know, a multinational, worldwide community of monasteries, all trying to maintain a similar standard, with, of course, variations from place to place, but still with a very strong core. It's recognizable as an Ajahn Chah monastery. All of them are situated in forests. This is part of the forest tradition, and Ajahn Chah would really emphasize the importance of life in the forest. His teachings around nature, all that we need to know, we can learn from nature. Just the cycles of birth, aging, death, the cycles of arising, maintaining, disbanding, the teachings, experience of changeability, impermanence that are so obvious in nature, natural settings, that just to immerse ourselves in it is a big step in gaining insight into impermanence, changeability. He emphasized that that's, you know, this is where we can learn, this is where we really take the training to the heart. We don't need to spend huge amounts of time learning academic teachings or, you know, the suttas, that kind of thing, although those are very useful as a basis. But after we get some grounding in that, we really need to take it in. And just by observing, just by watching, by reflecting on the world around us, particularly in these natural settings, that's enough to realize the teachings. Keeping it simple. He emphasized community a lot. Tell of his experience in his early days after he was ordained and then decided to go off and wander, practice in places of solitude, pristine forests, and how he developed a lot of peace and tranquility in those kinds of settings, really developed concentration. But would find that when he came back into the monastery or society group settings, that all of his defilements would just rise again in the company of other people, similar to that reading from Ajahn Sumedho the other day. And the importance of being able to be mobile and versatile with the practice and not just be dependent on a certain set of conditions, to maintain a contented, peaceful state of mind. That the daily grind of being in community with other people was important in challenging our underlying defilements, bringing them to the surface so that we could see them clearly. There's the story of when Ajahn Chah came to England, and Ajahn Sumedho had just started the communities there, of Ajahn Chah asking Ajahn Sumedho, how's it going here in these early days? And Ajahn Sumedho saying, great, you know, everything is really harmonious, people are getting along well, taking an interest in what we're doing, the community is thriving, it's really going very, very smoothly. And Ajahn Chah's response of, well, you'll never learn anything that way. So really taking the long haul getting down to being in community, working out all of the different ways that we need to learn self-effacement in a community, particularly in a larger community as it grows. That kind of learning of how to bend and how to let go of views and opinions, how to set aside what it is that I want to do and do what it is that others would like to do, as the Buddha talks about in the teachings. This is a very important part of letting go of that self-cherishing, that self-perception, self-involvement. Life in community, and also including work, the importance of being able to maintain that sense of all-around awareness, whether you're sitting on the cushion or engaged in activity, and work in the monastery being an integral part of that, you know, not only for the practical reasons of needing to maintain the environment and the buildings and the structures and the property, but also as a way of learning how to be adaptable and to take mindfulness and clear awareness off the cushion and into daily engagement. Another great example of Ajahn Sumedho's early days, as I've heard anyway, his opinion when he was a young monk, just coming into Wat Pa Phong, staying with Ajahn Chah, his opinion that the most important part of the practice was meditation, and that involvement in too many work projects was, you know, not something that was going to be real beneficial for him, that the real practice was meditation, solitude, getting down to it. And so there was a work project that was going on or beginning at Wat Pa Phong, and all the monks were going to be joining in it and getting out there and doing some hard physical labor. And as I heard the story, Ajahn Sumedho went to Ajahn Chah and said, well, you know, that's all well and good, but I don't think that's really what is most important for my practice. What's most important for my practice is to spend my time in meditation, practicing meditation, and I'd like to request to do that. And Ajahn Chah saying, yes, of course, yes. And meditation is very important. You should be given the special chance to develop that. That's the most important thing. And then in his kind of very clever and, in this case, indirect, direct way, when the assembly formed to begin the work project, and Ajahn Sumedho was there as well, Ajahn Chah announcing to the whole group of monastics gathered, and just to let you know, Ajahn Sumedho will not be joining in the work project. He feels that the most important thing is for him to be practicing meditation, so we'll all be out there doing the work, and Ajahn Sumedho will be inside practicing the meditation, which is the most important thing. Just wanted to let you all know that. And so, of course, everybody was silent. Nobody would say anything. And began the work period, and Ajahn Sumedho went to his kuti. But it wasn't too long, I don't think, before Ajahn Sumedho realized I've been had. And just realized that it was just his own, you know, kind of spiritual self-importance that was saying that he was, in a sense, more important, his practice was more important than what needed to be done and to the community, and gave up, went out and joined the crew, having learned his lesson. So that image of Ajahn Chah sticks with me too as being not giving the Westerners any special treatment, as he would always describe, you know, you've come here, you're going to be one of the monks just like everybody else, but also finding clever ways to point this out and to deliver the teaching without just coming down hard and saying, no, you're going to get out there and work with everybody else. Ways to drive it home. So the importance of work and community were very much a part of the Ajahn Chah tradition, which we see brought down through us, or through Lungpa Pasano to Abhayagiri as well. A very strict adherence to Vinaya standards. We follow a very strict code, trying to keep it as close as we can reasonably keep it to the original teachings as we understand them, but without being judgmental of other traditions that don't hold the same standard, but just taking it on, not as a something to develop a sense of self-importance or arrogance around, but to develop it as a training, as a very, very useful training in relinquishment, renunciation, mindfulness, as a basis for our practice. And how that has maintained a pretty strong standard throughout all of the Ajahn Chah communities. And the teachings just around the formal practice, the meditation, Ajahn Chah was never one to describe a set particular technique of meditation. He was always willing to share his own practices and describe the various kinds of practices that one could pick up, but not saying this is the way to do it here, this is the Wat Pa Pong practice, but rather more a sense of attitude and understanding so that one could pick up the various meditation objects, kamatana, that were appropriate for each individual and also for the time and place in one's own practice, and to pick them up with investigation, with interest, and the willingness to try it out, work with it, and evaluate the results for oneself. Of course, within the bounds of the, you know, the general teachings and the general tradition, but with a fair amount of flexibility to find what was most suitable, and to develop that sense of being able to judge for oneself the effectiveness of a particular meditation practice, of a particular technique. That's an essential skill, to be able to evaluate our own progress, our own practice. His emphasis on sila, morality, virtue, the precepts. One of the teachings that sticks in my mind is the story of one of the villagers who was gaining faith in Ajahn Chah and spending more time learning about the practice, and but still, of course, living in the village, living in the community, and growing up in a kind of a agricultural hunter-gatherer society that they had there, so that even keeping the first precept of not taking the life of any living creature would be difficult, because pretty much anything that moved in the forest was fair game for food. And so frogs were one of the abundant creatures that people would eat. And so this villager, as many would do, would be hunting frogs and finding them and then plopping them into a boiling vat of water for their meal. And Ajahn Chah, you know, would talk to this villager as he would to everyone about the first precept, not taking the life of any living creature. And this presented quite a dilemma to this man, you know, who felt like he had to provide food for his family. And this was, you know, there wasn't a huge abundance of food at that time in that area. And so the dilemma of how to feed his family while keeping that precept. And, you know, not getting a lot of support from his family to do it, he would talk with Ajahn Chah about the need to keep on doing that. And Ajahn Chah's approach was a very gentle one, but still quite instructive. Was, well, try this out. Just before you take that frog and toss it into this boiling vat of water, just hold it. And hold it in front of your face and look at it. Just look at this frog. Maybe look at it in the eye before you do it. Just do that much. And so the man said, okay, I'll do that. And of course, as soon as he started doing that, he just couldn't, he couldn't do it anymore. So that kind of wisdom of not just telling somebody to keep a rule because they should, or, you know, because the Buddha said so, or because of the innate harmfulness of it, or trying to, explain it on a conceptual level, but to take it into one's own experience. Look at what it is that you're doing. Look at the effect that it has in your mind. Take the time to actually see the effect of breaking a precept, see the effect of keeping a precept. Finding out for yourself, well, what does it really feel like when I change the way I deal with this kind of situation? Taking it to heart, taking it to experience, not just as a conceptual practice. And Ajahn Chah's also emphasis on right view, kind of his relentless teaching to see the world through the lens of Dhamma, see the world in terms of anicca, dukkha, anatta, impermanence, changeability, unsatisfactoriness, and not self. To just regard all experience consistently in that way, not just on the meditation cushion, not just as a insight, reflection after you've attained a stable, concentrated state of mind, of course, all of which is good, but just to take it into your daily experience. Every experience as you move through the day, constantly refreshing that reflection, changeable, unstable, uncertain, ultimately not going to satisfy, not who I am, not mine, not me. As he would say, throwing it all into the garbage cans of anicca, dukkha, anatta, just tossing it all into the, relinquishing. The talk that Ajahn Pasana was giving the other night on at Wapapong that we saw a little bit of on YouTube, the last part that I saw was in talking about Ajahn Chah's continuous teaching on relinquishment, both externally and internally, letting go, knowing and letting go, constant reflection of seeing what's there just as it is, and letting go of any grasping or clinging to anything, any object, any state of mind, any idea, any experiences, it all arises and ceases. Don't hold on to it, relinquish it. Just that relentless practice of completely letting go because of understanding its transitoriness anyway. So these are some of the core teachings that I think of in relation to Ajahn Chah, all of these things come together, form a image of my in my mind of who he was and what he has brought to the world, the legacy he's left, and that it still continues and grows many years after his passing away. So I think I'll leave my own musings about Ajahn Chah there, and I'd like to take a little bit of time to do a reading. It's entitled Toward the Unconditioned. I'm not going to read absolutely the whole thing and skip around a little bit, but mostly most of it. The Buddha talked about sankata dhammas and asankata dhammas, conditioned and unconditioned things. Conditioned things are innumerable, material or immaterial, big or small. If our mind is under the influence of delusion, it will proliferate about these things, dividing them up into good and bad, short and long, coarse and refined. Why does the mind proliferate like this? Because it doesn't know determined reality. It doesn't see the Dhamma. Not seeing the Dhamma, the mind is full of clinging. As long as the mind is held down by clinging, there can be no escape. There is confusion, birth, old age, sickness, and death, even in the thinking processes. This kind of mind is called the Sankata Dhamma, conditioned mind. Asankata Dhamma, the unconditioned, refers to the mind which has seen Dhamma, the truth, of the five khandhas as they are, as transient, imperfect, and ownerless. All ideas of me and them, mine and theirs, belong to the determined reality. Really, they are all conditions. When we know the truth of conditions, as neither ourselves nor belonging to us, we let go of conditions and the determined. When we let go of conditions, we attain the Dhamma, we enter into and realize the Dhamma. When we attain the Dhamma, we know clearly. What do we know? We know that there are only conditions and determinations, no being, no self, no us, nor them. This is knowledge of the way things are. Seeing in this way, the mind transcends things. The body may grow old, get sick, and die, but the mind transcends this state. When the mind transcends conditions, it knows the unconditioned. The mind becomes the unconditioned, the state which no longer contains conditioning factors. The mind is no longer conditioned by the concerns of the world. Conditions no longer contaminate the mind. Pleasure and pain no longer affect it. Nothing can affect the mind or change it. The mind is assured. It has escaped all constructions. Seeing the true nature of conditions and the determined, the mind becomes free. This freed mind is called the unconditioned, that which is beyond the power of constructing influences. If the mind doesn't really know conditions and determinations, it is moved by them. Encountering good, bad, pleasure, or pain, it proliferates about them. Why does it proliferate? Because there is still a cause. What is the cause? The cause is the understanding that the body is oneself or belongs to the self, that feelings are self or belonging to self, that perception is self or belonging to self, that conceptual thought is self or belonging to self, that consciousness is self or belonging to self. The tendency to conceive things in terms of self is the source of happiness, suffering, birth, old age, sickness, and death. This is the worldly mind, spinning around and changing at the directives of worldly conditions. This is the conditioned mind. If we receive some windfall, our mind is conditioned by it. That object influences our mind into a feeling of pleasure, but when it disappears, our mind is conditioned by it into suffering. The mind becomes a slave of conditions, a slave of desire. No matter what the world presents to it, the mind is moved accordingly. This mind has no refuge. It is not yet assured of itself, not yet free. It is still lacking a firm base. This mind doesn't yet know the truth of conditions. Such is the conditioned mind. All of you listening to the Dhamma here, reflect for a while. Even a child can make you angry, isn't that so? Even a child can trick you. He could trick you into crying, laughing. He could trick you into all sorts of things. Even old people get duped by these things. The mind of a deluded person who doesn't know the truth of conditions is always being shaped into countless reactions, such as love, hate, pleasure, and pain. They shape our minds like this because we are enslaved by them. We are slaves of tanha, craving. Craving gives all the orders, and we simply obey. I hear people complaining, "Oh, I'm so miserable. Night and day I have to go to the fields. I have no time at home. In the middle of the day, I have to work in the hot sun with no shade. No matter how cold it is, I can't stay at home. I have to go to work. I'm so oppressed." If I ask them, "Why don't you just leave home and become a monk?" They say, "I can't leave. I have responsibilities." Tanha pulls them back. Sometimes when you're doing the plowing, you might be bursting to urinate so much, you just have to do it while you're plowing, like the buffaloes. This is how much craving enslaves them. When I ask, "How are you going? Haven't you got time to come to the monastery?" They say, "Oh, I'm in really deep. I don't know what it is that they're stuck in so deeply." These are just conditions, concoctions. The Buddha taught to see appearances as such, to see conditions as they are. This is seeing the Dhamma, seeing things as they really are. If you really see these two things, you must throw them out. Let them go. No matter what you may receive, it has no real substance. At first it may seem good, but it will eventually go bad. It will make you love and make you hate, make you laugh and cry, make you go whichever way it pulls you. Why is this? Because the mind is undeveloped. Conditions become conditioning factors of the mind, making it big and small, happy and sad. In the time of our forefathers, when a person died, they would invite the monks to go and recite the recollections on impermanence. Anicca vata sankhara upadvaya damino upajitva niruchanti tesan upasamo sukho. Impermanent are all conditioned things, of the nature to arise and pass away. Having been born, they all must perish. The cessation of conditions is true happiness. All conditions are impermanent. The body and mind are both impermanent. They are impermanent because they do not remain fixed and unchanging. All things that are born must necessarily change. They are transient, especially our body. What is there that doesn't change with this body? Are hair, nails, teeth, skin still the same as they used to be? The condition of the body is constantly changing, so it is impermanent. Is the body stable? Is the mind stable? Think about it. How many times is there arising and ceasing, even in one day? Both body and mind are constantly arising and ceasing. Conditions are in a state of constant turmoil. The reason you can't see these things in line with the truth is because you keep believing the untrue. It's like being guided by a blind man. How can you travel in safety? A blind man will only lead you into forests and thickets. How could he lead you to safety when he can't see? In the same way, our mind is deluded by conditions, creating suffering in the search for happiness, creating difficulty in the search for ease. Such a mind only makes for difficulty and suffering. Really, we want to get rid of suffering and difficulty, but instead we create those very things. All we can do is complain. We create bad causes, and the reason we do is because we don't know the truth of appearances and conditions. Appearances are determined into existence. Why must we determine them? Because they don't intrinsically exist. For example, suppose somebody wanted to make a marker. He would take a piece of wood or a rock and place it on the ground, and then call it a marker. Actually, it's not a marker. There isn't any marker. That's why you must determine it into existence. In the same way, we determine cities, people, cattle, everything. Why must we determine these things? Because originally they do not exist. Concepts such as monk and layperson are also determinations. We determine these things into existence because intrinsically they aren't here. It's like having an empty dish. You can put anything you like it into it because it's empty. This is the nature of determined reality. Men and women are simply determined concepts, as are all the things around us. If we know the truth of determinations clearly, we will know that there are no beings, because beings are determined things. understanding that these things are simply determinations, you can be at peace. But if you believe that that person, being, the mine, the theirs, and so on, are intrinsic qualities, then you must laugh and cry over them. These are the proliferations of conditioning factors. If we take such things to be ours, there will always be suffering. This is micchaditti, wrong view. Names are not intrinsic realities, they are provisional truths. Only after we are born do we obtain names, isn't that so? Or did you have your name already when you were born? The name usually comes afterwards, right? Why must we determine these names? Because intrinsically they aren't there. We should clearly understand these determinations. Good, evil, high, low, black and white are all determinations. We are all lost in determinations. This is why at the funeral ceremonies the monks chant, Anicca Vanta Sankara, conditions are impermanent, they arise and pass away. That's the truth. What is there that, having arisen, doesn't cease? Good moods arise and then cease. Have you ever seen anybody cry for 3 or 4 years? At the most, you may see people crying a whole night, and then the tears dry up. Having arisen, they cease. Tesan wu pasamosu ko. If we understand sankharas, proliferations, and thereby subdue them, this is the greatest happiness. To be calmed of proliferations, calmed of being, calmed of individuality, of the burden of self, is true merit. Transcending these things, one sees the unconditioned. This means that no matter what happens, the mind doesn't proliferate around it. There's nothing that can throw the mind off its natural balance. What else could you want? This is the end, the finish. The Buddha taught the way things are. Our making offerings and listening to Dhamma talks and so on is in order to search for and realize this. If we realize this, we don't have to go and study Vipassana. It will happen of itself. Both samatha and vipassana are determined into being, just like other determinations. The mind which knows, which is beyond such things, is the culmination of the practice. Our practice, our inquiry, is in order to transcend suffering. When clinging is finished with, states of being are finished with. When states of being are finished with, there is no more birth or death. When things are going well, the mind does not rejoice. And when things are going badly, the mind does not grieve. The mind is not dragged all over the place by the tribulations of the world, and so the practice is finished. This is the basic principle for which the Buddha gave the teaching. The Buddha taught the Dhamma for use in our lives. Even when we die, there is the teaching, Tesang Mupaso Mosuko. But we don't subdue these conditions, we only carry them around, as if the monks were telling us to do so. We carry them around and cry over them. This is getting lost in conditions. Heaven, hell, and Nibbana are all to be found at this point. Practicing the Dhamma is in order to transcend suffering in the mind. If we know the truth of things as I've explained here, we will automatically know the Four Noble Truths. Suffering, the cause of suffering, the cessation of suffering, and the way leading to the cessation of suffering. People are generally ignorant when it comes to determinations. They think they all exist of themselves. When the books tell us that trees, mountains, and rivers are non-mind-attended conditions, this is simplifying things. This is just the superficial teaching. There's no reference to suffering as if there was no suffering in the world. This is just the shell of Dhamma. If we were to explain things in terms of ultimate truth, we would see that it's people who go and tie all these things down with their attachments. How can you say that things have no power to shape events, that they are not mind-attended, when people will beat their children even over one tiny needle? One single plate or cup, a plank of wood. The mind attends all these things. Just watch what happens if someone goes and smashes one of them up and you'll find out. Everything is capable of influencing us in this way. Knowing these things fully is our practice, examining those things which are conditioned, unconditioned, mind-attended, and non-mind-attended. This is part of the external teaching, as the Buddha once referred to them. At one time, the Buddha was staying in a forest. Taking a handful of leaves, he asked the bhikkhus,
Bhikkhus, which is great, which is the greater number, the leaves I hold in my hand or the leaves scattered over the forest floor? The bhikkhus answered, the leaves in the Blessed One's hand are few. The leaves scattered around the forest floor are by far the greater number. In the same way, bhikkhus, the whole of the Buddha's teachings is vast, but these are not the essence of things. They are not directly related to the way out of suffering. There are so many aspects to the teaching, but what the Tathagata really wants you to do is to transcend suffering, to inquire into things, and abandon clinging and attachment to form, feeling, perception, volition, and consciousness. Stop clinging to these things, and you will transcend suffering. These teachings are like the leaves in the Buddha's hand. You don't need so much. Just a little is enough. As for the rest of the teaching, you needn't worry yourselves over it. It's just like the vast earth, abundant with grasses, soil, mountains, forests. There's no shortage of rocks and pebbles, but all of those rocks are not as valuable as one single jewel. The Dhamma of the Buddha is like this. You don't need a lot. So whether you are talking about the Dhamma or listening to it, you should know the Dhamma. You needn't wonder where the Dhamma is. It's right here. No matter where you go to study the Dhamma, it is really in the mind. The mind is the one who clings. The mind is the one who speculates. The mind is the one who transcends, who lets go. All this external study is really about the mind. No matter if you study the Tipitaka, the Abhidhamma, or whatever, don't forget where it came from. When it comes to the practice, the only things you really need to make a start are honesty and integrity. You don't need to make a lot of trouble for yourself. None of you lay people have studied the Tipitaka, but you are still capable of greed, anger, and delusion, aren't you? Where did you learn about these things from? Did you have to read the Tipitaka or the Abhidhamma to have greed, hatred, and delusion? Those things are already there in your mind. You don't have to study books to have them. But the teachings are for inquiring into and abandoning these things. Let the knowing spread from within you, and you will be practicing rightly. If you want to see a train, just go to the central station. You don't have to go traveling all the way up the northern line, the southern line, the eastern line, and the western line to see all the trains. If you want to see trains, every single one of them, you'd be better off waiting at Grand Central Station. That's where they all terminate. Now, some people tell me, I want to practice, but I don't know how. I'm not up to studying the scriptures. I'm getting old now. My memory's not good. Just look right here at Central Station. Greed arises here. Anger arises here. Delusion arises here. Just sit here and you can watch all these things arise. Practice right here, because right here is where you're stuck. Right here is where the determined arises, where conventions arise. And right here is where the Dhamma will arise. Therefore, the practice of Dhamma doesn't distinguish between class or race. All it asks is that we look into, see, and understand. At first, we train the body and speech to be free of taints, which is sila. Some people think that to have sila, you must memorize Pali phrases and chant all day and all night. But really, all you have to do is to make your body and speech blameless. And that's sila. It's not so difficult to understand, just like cooking food. Put in a little bit of this and a little bit of that till it's just right, and it's delicious. You don't have to add anything else to make it delicious. It's delicious already, if only you add the right ingredients. In the same way, taking care that our actions and speech are proper will give us sila. Dhamma practice can be done anywhere. In the past, I traveled all over looking for a teacher because I didn't know how to practice. I was always afraid that I was practicing wrongly. I'd be constantly going from one mountain to another, from one place to another, until I stopped and reflected on it. Now I understand. In the past, I must have been quite stupid. I went all over the place looking for places to practice meditation. I didn't realize it was already there, in my heart. All the meditation you want is right there inside you. There is birth, old age, sickness, and death right here within you. That's why the Buddha said, Pachatang Weditabo Winyuhi. The wise must know for themselves. I'd said the words before, but I still didn't know their meaning. I traveled all over looking for it until I was ready to drop dead from exhaustion. Only then, when I stopped, did I find what I was looking for inside of me? So now I can tell you about it. So in your practice of sila, just practice as I've explained here. Don't doubt the practice. Even though some people may say you can't practice at home, that there are too many obstacles. If that's the case, then even eating and drinking are going to be obstacles. If these things are obstacles to practice, then don't eat. If you stand on a thorn, is that good? Isn't not standing on a thorn better? Dhamma practice brings benefit to all people, irrespective of class. However much you practice, that's how much you will know the truth. Some people say they can't practice as a layperson. The environment is too crowded. If you live in a crowded place, then look into crowdedness. Make it open and wide. The mind has been deluded by crowdedness. Train it to know the truth of crowdedness. The more you neglect the practice, the more you neglect going to the monastery and listening to the teaching, the more your mind will sink down into the bog, like a frog going into a hole. Someone comes along with a hook and the frog's done for. He doesn't have a chance. All he can do is stretch out his neck and offer it to them. So watch out that you don't work yourself into a tiny corner. Someone may just come along with a hook and scoop you up. At home, being pestered by your children and grandchildren, you are even worse off than the frog. You don't know how to detach from these things. When old age, sickness, and death come along, what will you do? This is the hook that's going to get you. Which way will you turn? This is the predicament our minds are in, engrossed in the children, the relatives, the possessions, and you don't know how to let them go. Without morality or understanding to free things up, there is no way out for you. When feeling, perception, volition, and consciousness produce suffering, you always get caught up in it. Why is there this suffering? If you don't investigate, you won't know. If happiness arises, you simply get caught up in happiness, delighting in it. You don't ask yourself, where does this happiness come from? So change your understanding. You can practice anywhere because the mind is with you everywhere. If you think good thoughts while sitting, you can be aware of them. If you think bad thoughts, you can be aware of them also. These things are with you while lying down. If you think good thoughts or bad thoughts, you can know them also, because the place to practice is in the mind. Some people think you have to go to the monastery every single day. That's not necessary. Just look at your own mind. If you know where the practice is, you'll be assured. The Buddha's teaching tells us to watch ourselves, not to run after fads and superstitions. That's why he said, "Silena sugatinyanti, moral rectitude leads to well-being. Silena bhogasampada, moral rectitude leads to wealth. Silena nibbutinyanti, moral rectitude leads to nibbana. Tasma silan visotaye, therefore maintain your precepts purely." All beings fare according to their kama. What is kama? People are too gullible. If you do bad actions, they say Yama, the king of the underworld, will write it all down in a book. When you go there, he takes out his accounts and looks you up. You're all afraid of the Yama in the afterlife, but you don't know the Yama within your own minds. If you do bad actions, even if you sneak off and do it by yourself, this Yama will write it all down. There are probably many among you people sitting here who have secretly done bad things, not letting anyone else see. But you see it, don't you? This Yama sees it all. Can you see it for yourself? All of you, think for a while. Yama has written it all down, hasn't he? There's no way you can escape it, whether you do it alone or in a group, in a field or whatever. Is there anybody here who has ever stolen anything? There are probably a few of us who are ex-thieves. Even if you don't steal other people's things, you may steal your own. I myself have that tendency. That's why I reckon some of you may be the same. Maybe you have secretly done bad things in the past, not letting anyone else know about it. But even if you don't tell anyone else about it, you must know about it. This is the Yama who watches over you and writes it all down. In this Buddhist religion, you must be aware of all of your actions. We don't act like the Brahmins who go into your house and say, "May you be well and strong, may you live long." The Buddha doesn't talk like that. How will the disease go away with just talk? The Buddha's way of treating the sick was to say, before you were sick, what happened? What led up to your sickness? Then you tell him how it came about. Oh, it's like that, is it? Take this medicine and try it out. If it's not the right medicine, he tries another one. If it's right for the illness, then that's the right one. This way is scientifically sound. The Buddha didn't want us to put too much store in these things. He wanted us to practice with reason. Buddhism has been around for thousands of years now, and most people have continued to practice as their teachers have taught them, regardless of whether it's right or wrong. That's stupid. They simply follow the example of their forebears. The Buddha didn't encourage this sort of thing. He wanted us to do things with reason. For example, at one time when he was teaching the monks, he asked Venerable Sariputta, "Sariputta, do you believe this teaching?" Venerable Sariputta replied, "I don't yet believe it." The Buddha praised his answer. "Very good, Sariputta. A wise person doesn't believe too readily. He looks into things, into their causes and conditions, and sees their true nature before believing or disbelieving." But most teachers these days would say, "What? You don't believe me? Get out of here." Most people are afraid of their teachers. Whatever their teachers do, they blindly follow. The Buddha taught to adhere to the truth. Listen to the teaching and then consider it intelligently. Inquire into it. It's the same with my Dhamma talks. Go and consider it. Is what I say right? Really look into it. Look within yourself. All things are just as they are. They don't cause suffering in themselves, just like a thorn, a really sharp thorn. Does it make you suffer? No, it's just a thorn. It doesn't bother anybody. But if you go ahead and stand on it, then you'll suffer. Why is there this suffering? Because you stepped on the thorn. The thorn is just minding its own business. It doesn't harm anybody. Only if you step on the thorn will you suffer over it. It's because of ourselves that there's pain. Form, feeling, perception, volition, consciousness, all things in this world are simply there as they are. It's us who picks fights with them. And if we hit them, they're going to hit us back. If they're left on their own, they won't bother anybody. Only the swaggering drunkard gives them trouble. All conditions are fair according to their nature. That's why the Buddha said, "Te sang wu pasamosuko." If we subdue conditions, seeing determinations and conditions as they really are, as neither me nor mine, us nor them, when we see that these beliefs are simply sakkaya ditti, self, which is self-identification view, the conditions are freed of the self-delusion. Once you look into the true nature of determinations and conditions, pride cannot prevail. Other people's fathers are just like our father, their mothers are just like ours, their children are just like ours. We see the happiness and suffering of other beings as just like ours. If we see in this way, we can come face to face with the future Buddha. It's not so difficult. Everyone is in the same boat. Then the world will be as smooth as a drum skin. If you want to wait around to meet Prat Sri Aryamaitreya, the future Buddha, then just don't practice. You'll probably be around long enough to see him. But he's not crazy that he'd take people like that for disciples. Most people just doubt. If you no longer doubt about the self, then no matter what people may say about you, you aren't concerned, because your mind has let go. It is at peace. Conditions become subdued, grasping after the forms of practice. That teacher is bad, that place is no good, this is right, that's wrong. No, there's none of these things. All this kind of thinking is all smoothed over. You come face to face with the future Buddha. Those who only hold up their hands and pray will never get there. So this is the practice. If I talked any more, it would be just more of the same. Another talk would be just the same as this. I've brought you this far. Now you think about it. I've brought you to the path. Whoever's going to go, it's there for you. Those who aren't going can stay. The Buddha only sees you to the beginning of the path. The Tathagata only points the way. For my practice, he only taught this much. The rest was up to me. Now I teach you. I can tell you just this much. I can bring you only to the beginning of the path. Whoever wants to go back can go back. Whoever wants to travel on can travel on. It's up to you now.
Sadhu.